Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 81. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Shepherds for Science by W.C. Tuttle, narrated by Steve Howell. Wilbur Coleman Tuttle was an American writer who produced almost exclusively Western stories, primarily for pulp magazines. Born in 1883, he sold more than 1,000 magazine stories and dozens of novels in his lifetime. He even wrote 52 film scripts during the silent era. In a 1930 poll of its readers, Tuttle was voted the most popular writer in Adventure magazine, which is also where this week's story was published. He died in Los Angeles County in 1969. Steve Howell lives in South Carolina with his wife and two sons. After 22 years in the U.S. Army, he plans to retire to civilian life this year and focus on writing fiction. He's an occasional narrator for the District of Wonders, with three stories already on Protecting Project Pulp. Find his blog at stephentthowell.wordpress.com. So saddle up, it's time for Shepherds for Science by W.C. Tuttle, narrated by Stephen Howell.
Me and Dirty Shirt Jones prods our three burrows across the border of Yellow Rock County, points north through the country where God dumped the leavings after he made the Badlands, and has visions of the old hometown. Me and Dirty has abandoned the idea of finding gold where she ain't, and right now we're herding our sore-footed jassacks towards the flesh pots of Pipe Rock Town. We're cutting around the side of a hill when all at once we discern the figure of a man sitting on a rock ahead of us. He looks a heap like he was figuring out the why and what for of all things. He humps there in the sun, a long, lean, pathetic-looking figure, despondency showing even in the curves of his cartridge belt. I feel sorry for him long before our lead burro halts before him and lets us arrive. The figure raises his head, peers at that gray burro, and when we stop, he gets to his feet, turns to us, and snaps. "Hold up your hands, both of you." He and Dirty jerks our hands above our heads, and this fretful-looking hombre with the goodbye-forever mustache and weary eyes squints at us and says, "You both solemnly swear to uphold the law vested in you as deputy sheriffs of Yellow Rock County, so help you God." Me and Dirty nods and puts down our hands. "Now," says Magpie Simpkins, sheriff of Yellow Rock County, "I feel a dang sight better." We nods again, sits down beside him, and rolls smokes. After a while, Magpie scratches his nose and pinches out the light of his cigarette. "What you doing here, hunting snakes?" asks Dirty. Magpie shakes his head and digs into the dirt with his heels. "Of course, it ain't none of our business," says I, "but I would like to know why you inoculates us with sheriffitis without warning." "Sheep," says he, soft-like. "Just sheep, Ike." "Which there never was, nor never will be," says Dirty. "You mean just plain sheep, don't you, Magpie?" "That is as may be, Dirty." Magpie fingers his mustache and nods. "Well," says I, "me and Dirty hankers for home, so I reckon we might as well drift along, Magpie." "No," says he, sad-like. "You ain't going no place, Ike. You're arrived. Do you reckon I deputized you for fun?" "Sheep," pronounces Dirty. "Don't mean nothing at all to me. I sure am contemptuous of all things pertaining to wool." "Me, I votes against anything that blats," says I. "I don't love 'em," snaps Magpie. "Don't see me packing no sheep dip to alleviate their sufferings, do you?" We don't seem to, so we all sits there, humped over in the sun. After a while, Magpie clears his throat. "Alphabetical Alien and Scenery Sims own 3,000 woolies," says he. "Scenery was a silent partner, being as he's a cowman, which hates sheep. Alfie gets Scenery to unhook $1,000 to buy some fancy stocks, Abby. Well, Alfie bought 'em red, white, and blue ones in stacks, the same of which ain't productive none to speak about. Scenery chides Alfie to the extent that Alfie gets disgruntled and wishes to separate the herd 50-50 without considering the 1,000 he lost over the green cloth. Alfie contends that him and Scenery has agreed to suffer gains and losses together, and furthermore that he lost a lot of his own money at the same sitting, the same of which makes them fellow sufferers. Such an open declaration causes some smoke and a little noise in Pipe Rock, but neither of them gets shot up enough for us to declare a holiday. Scenery plasters an attachment on the herd, and then Alfie limps to Judge Steele's wiki up and prays for a receiver. Being as I'm the sheriff, I has to serve said attachment. And also being as I'm a dang fool, I'm appointed as the receiver. The county didn't elect me to herd sheep, gents. Over on the other side of that hill is the sheep. Somewhere over there is the tent. All very simple. Magpie fusses with his mustache for a moment and then gets to his feet. He slaps our lead burro with his hat, hitches up his belt. Come on, mules, hump yourselves.
Where to, feller?
Asked Dirty. Them's our burros, Magpie. You won't need 'em, says he, weary-like. So I'll take 'em home for you. All I ask is this. Take care of the sheep.
Sheep?
I yells. S-H-E-E-P, he spells, counting the letters on the fingers of his left hand with the barrel of the gun in his right. Just sheep, Ike. Keep your hands off that gun.
Yeah! That's Dirty, excited-like. Explain yourself, feller.
You, Magpie points at Dirty, are the receiver, shabby. I hereby makes you deputy receiver of them sheep, and I honors Ike by making him deputy attacher. Ike always was attached to sheep. May the Lord have a little mercy on your souls and don't lose any sheep. Come on, canaries. Me and Dirty sits there like a pair of mummies and watches that forlorn-looking hombre herd our long-eared rolling stock across the hills. Dirty jerks a rock at a sand lizard and yanks his hat down over his ears. We glares at each other for a moment.
Shepherd, hisses Dirty. You sheep attacher.
Ditto, I hisses back at him. You sheep receptacle. If there ever was an age when Jack Rabbit spoke with tin whistle voices, Scenery Sims was a throwback to that period. Him and alphabetical alien are two things, the same of which the dictionary designates as inanimate objects. If you can imagine a pair of ciphers with the rims rubbed out, you've got my opinion of them two hombres to a gnat's eyebrow.
I'm going to kill Magpie Simmons someday, says Dirty, mean-like.
Uh-huh, says I. That sounds like you, Dirty. You're always going to kill somebody the day after. You think too slow. We sits there a while longer, and then Dirty yawns.
Might as well find them, I reckon. You touch them, and I'll do the receiving, Ike.
We pokes over the ridge, and after going about a mile, we hears the voices of lamblets, and then we sees a teepee, which we deciphers to be the sheep camp. In her callow youth, she might have been a tent, but the wear and tear of sheep in existence has put her in the seared and yellow leaf with a touch of color, where somebody's red flannel shirt has patched up a hole in one side.
Well, says Dirty, she ain't much, but it's home, Ike.
It is ever so humble, I agrees, and we slid down to it. As we walks up to the front, the flap opens, and out comes the head of an inhuman being. His face is so classified because no human being could have so much hair on his face and still breathe, not without gills.
Holy hen hawks, gasped Dirty. Who have we here?
I am the sheep herder,
comes from a hole in the hair.
Bale of hay from Sweden,
gasped Dirty, and the hair opens again.
I am the sheep herder.
What a dugout for dandruff, says I.
Yeah, who are you, fowlers?
Your successors, says I. You can tie up your war sack and pilgrim.
Huh?
He seems to think it over and shakes his head.
I think I stay. This is my job. I am the ship herder.
You don't need to classify yourself, grins Dirty. Nature tagged you. Us two are going to dry nurse this bunch of animated socks and underwears. You may as well kiss them a fond fare thee well. The hairy one shakes his head and peers at us out of a pair of little eyes. He say to me, "Olaf, I give you $20 a month." He say that, and I stay for 1 month. 15 day I stay today. "This has been a long day for you, Olaf," agrees Dirty. "Ike, you get that jargon?" "Sure. Alphabetical or scenery promised him 20 a month, and today makes 15 days he has reigned." "No rain," says Olaf. "Dry as I stay." He ducked back under the tent, and a second later he sticks his head out again, and beside that bunch of hair is the muzzle of a rifle. "I think I stay," he announces, and ducks inside again. "Defied by a barber boy cotter," grunts Dirty. "Are we bluffed, Ike?" "Not from my point of view," says I. "You take one side, I'll take the other. There is 4 guy ropes on each side, and it just took 4 kicks per each to make that tent unsupporting." And the poor thing comes down upon Olaf. Then me and Dirty assumes reclining positions, while Olaf wastes a few cartridges, wild-like. Then he emerges from a hole in the wreck, in time to be mounted by Dirty Shirt, who rode that shepherd to the Queen's taste. Olaf pitched considerable, but gave up, and seemed receptive to civilized argument. "Still think you stay?" asked Dirty. "Well, I go pretty soon, but I come back now," pants Olaf, pawing the alkali out of his whiskers. "I boost something." "You talk like you had," admits Dirty. "I come back, yeah. I get the law." "Yeah? Look at us, shepherd. We're the law, sabby?" He looks at us, and his whiskers seem a heap agitated. "You are the law?" he asked, deliberate-like. "You are looking at it," grins Dirty. "How does she look?" "Well..." He hitches up his rope belt and picks up his war sack. "Well, I can say this much. Jorge Håkansson hey say to me, 'Olaf, this country has too much bum law and no justice.' Jorge is smart, you bet." And me and Dirty stood there and watched the hairy one fade out over the hills towards Silver Bend. "I hope he forgets us before he loads up on alcohol," says Dirty. "I hate to chase even a shepherd off his job, but I reckon we're sort of shepherds in law, Ike, and we ain't to blame. Let's inventory the grub." In the grub box is 1 can of milk, 1 can of corn, a little coffee, and a quart of raw alcohol. Dirty nods over the assortment. "That shepherd was good for 15 days more, Ike, but the law sure is going to suffer internally. Let's put up the tent." Olaf left too soon to enjoy the rain. She came down plentiful and awful, and demonstrated to us that red flannel ain't no ways waterproof. When the morning came, we peers out into a wet world and tries to dry out enough tobacco to make a smoke. Then cometh the interruption from without. "Say, you lousy, slew-footed, blat-headed sheep herd, come out here!" "Somebody calling you Dirty?" says I.
"Not me, Ike. Somebody been getting your mail."
"Coming out?" yells the voice again. "You sap-headed snake hunter?"
"Talks like a cow, man," opines Dirty. "Maybe he's making us a visit."
Dirty throws the tent flap open, and we gets us a view of a feller on a roan bronco. "Say, you," he begins, but he's looking down the muzzle of Dirty's gun, and his voice fails him.
"Speaking to me?" asked Dirty, soft-like.
"You better put down that gun," says he. "It might save you a lot of trouble."
"Yes," says Dirty. "And if it went off and killed you, feller, it'd likely save you a lot of trouble. If this is the way you're in the habit of speaking to strangers, what seemed to itch you?"
"Your sheep," he yelps. "Half your dang woolies are over my line. You agreed to keep them stinking sheep this side of the Mesquite, and this morning I finds half of them across. You get them out of there pretty dang sudden-like, or I'll massacre the bunch, savvy?"
"You don't dare," opines Dirty.
"I don't. Just about why?"
"It's against the law. Them sheep are within the law, mister."
"Yeah? Well, let me tell you one thing. You lousy shepherd, I'll get my punchers, and we'll show you. We'll chase him so far off."
"Get off," orders Dirty. You up so high I can't hear your voice.
He had a gun, but I reckon he also had a weak heart. So he got off and gave me his gun. I reckon he'd given us his weak heart, too, if we'd asked for it, because Dirty has a nervous way of fingering a trigger. What are you going to do now? He asks.
Hoard ships, grins Dirty. I'm a ship hoarder.
Oh, says he, you're the sweet herder that Alcohol Adam spoke about?
What'd he say?
Said you didn't have brains enough to wad a shotgun with.
What do you think? I asked.
Well, he looks at Dirty's gun, serious-like. Well, not to mean any offense, but I'd say that Alcohol exaggerated a little. He meant a .22.
Be it known that Alcohol Adams is so ornery that his own dog barks at him. He'd steal money from his own kids and then lick thunder out of them for losing it. Mosquitoes, horse flies, and rattlesnakes turned him down like a white chip in a no-limit stud game, and his soul was so small and elusive that he has to drink straight alcohol in order to exhilarate it. Yellow Rock got so disgusted with him that they sent him to the legislature, where he collected all the loose money in sight and showed his appreciation of things by passing a few laws favoring sheep. He orated his views in Pipe Rock, the same of which was contrary to our religion, and let me admit that some poor shooting was done. When he lit Paradise, there was 3 hunks of lead in the cantle of his saddle, which proved we held too low or the range was too great. We held a mass meeting that night, and Magpie Simpkins chided us over our lack of ability. We agreed to set aside 6 practice shots per day against the time that Alcohol or any other lawmaker might appear in our midst. I hope you hereby savvy something of Alcohol's nature.
You can't run no blazer on me, says this feller. I'm Sandy Sorensen. What are you going to do?
Bar your bronc, says Dirty. We ride that roan double, Ike.
Won't ride double, says he.
Maybe it never has, corrects Dirty, taking his foot out of the stirrup. Come on up, Ike.
Sandy sure diagnosed that bronc right. I'd trail my bet with his when he says it won't ride double, not meek-like. A bronc can't do his best with 290 pounds on his back, but I hope to gosh I never ride that bronc single-handed when it's riled. Man, that animal done everything except fly. And at that, the dang thing went high enough to convince the most skeptical that all it needed was a short pair of wings to make good in that respect. First, it gives a correct imitation of a post-hole digger. Then it goes down that gully, changing ends like a whirligig. I got my wishbone hooked over Dirty's shoulder, and every hop I can feel my finger slipping higher and higher up that cantle. Sandy rides a double rig saddle, and when we hits the first turn of the gully, I feel the rear cinch bust. From that on, it's like riding a rocking chair over sticks of dynamite. The roan bucks along the edge of the washout, the bottom of which is about 10 feet below us, and I just starts to yelp. Don't get scared, Dirty. She won't buck down there. When we hit the bottom, and I bit my tongue over the first word. My vertebrae comes together like a string of boxcars getting hit by a wild engine. Then we yanked out of there and went angling up the hill as fast as a bronc can run. Still alive? I yelps.
From my chin on up, he yells. Wonder what this fool wants to climb the hill for, Ike. Can't you stop her? Bridle's gone, Ike. Hang on!
We found out why the roan wanted to get a downhill pull on us. Because as soon as we hit the grade, the animal inaugurates a new style of bucking. Was it effective? Oh, man, I'd rise to remark it was. I just hung on and prayed. I used up all the white man's religion I ever heard about, and I'm just beginning to make medicine to the totem of the Alaskan Siwash when the cinch breaks. I feels myself float into space. Then I goes out in a blaze of bright lights. After a while, old man Misery seems to come along and runs his fingers all over my carcass. Then I opens my eyes. I'm lying on my back, my feet up on the side of a rock, and a short distance from me is Dirty, hanging by the back of his shirt to an old mesquite snag. Standing there beside a pair of packed burros is the queerest looking pair of pelicans I ever seen. They're both wearing hard hats and black rimmed specs, and what you might expect such persons to wear in the line of shirts, collars, and neckties, but from the waist on down, they're clad in chaps and boots. One of them is wearing a pair of Mexican spurs, the kind with rowels the size of $1.85. One of them has a belt draped around his waist, and in the holster is one of them single-shot .22 pistols. The other is packing a pump shotgun. One of them removes his specs and polishes them, careful-like. "Quite remarkable, my friend," says he. "Quite remarkable. The equine was no doubt desirous of removing its burden." "One would be led to accept such a theory," nods the other. "We have observed the effect, my dear Middleton, but of course we know nothing of the cause. It really was quite remarkable."
"Holy suffering scissor bills," grunts Dirty, leaving half his shirt on the snag and staggering to his feet. He stares at them and me.
"Hey, do you see the same thing I do?" he whispers.
"I hope so," says I, lowering my feet. "I hope I do, Dirty. Otherwise, I'm a goner mentally. Is one of them apparitions wearing spurs?"
"Thank,"
gasped Dirty.
"We see the same little details, Ike."
"You see, Pettingill," crows one of them. "You objected to the boots and spurs, but the customs of a country must be observed. It is well." "Perhaps they will enlighten us as to the best of their ability," says Pettingill, adjusting his specs. "It will do no harm to inquire." "My dear gentleman," says the one called Middleton, "may we ask you a question?"
"You can take a chance," nods Dirty.
Well, before I ask the question, it might be well to introduce ourselves. I am Professor Middleton of Boston, and the gentleman with me is Professor Pettingill of Philadelphia."
"We appreciates it considerable," says Dirty, solemn-like. "I am of the Jones tribe, from here or hereabouts, and called Dirty Shirt. The person with me is a Harper offspring called Ike."
"Where are you from, Ike?"
"There or thereabouts," says I.
"Exactly," says Professor Middleton.
"Now the question is this. Pettingill and myself are dabbling in a few problems outside of our regular work, and this one has come to our notice. Are sheep herders really insane, or do they acquire insanity from their occupation? Is there anything about a sheep that would cause a normal man to lose his mind, as it were?"
"Yes," nods Dirty. "It is."
"Exactly," says Middleton.
"You are following me?"
"I hope nobody sees me if I do," grins Dirty. "I contend that one's information on such a problem must come from personal observation and not from hearsay or opinions of others. We refuse to take circumstantial evidence, as it were. It seems that some of the natives are, well, a bit touchy on the subject. I asked a gentleman for his opinion, and he, well, he..."
"How so?" I asked.
"At your city of Silver Bend, I approached a man who was clad in leather trousers and asked him if I could get a little information from him regarding sheep. I am sure my tones were not belligerent, and I properly introduced myself before propounding the question."
"What did he say?" I asked.
"He did not answer. He deliberately crushed my hat over my nose and kicked my feet from under me."
"It is very true," nods the other one.
I thought perhaps we had met up with just the character we were investigating, a mentally unbalanced sheep person. I soothed him to the best of my ability, begging him to curb his profanity. Thinking to humor him, I said, in kind tones, "My dear fellow, there was no offense intended to you or your sheep. We all love the little lambs."
"Then what?" asked Dirty.
"Well, it may have been a coarse way of describing it, but another fellow came along after the mentally unbalanced one had stridden away, and he said,
'My, what a mess!'" "Who told you that shepherds is all crazy?" asked Dirty.
"It has been said," replies Professor Middleton. "We are investigating.
Just what does the word crazy mean? I asked.
Crazy? Professor Pettingill looked shocked at our ignorance. Crazy means decrepit, weak, feeble, of weakened or disordered intellect.
Come to think of it, remarked Professor Middleton, that party who assaulted us was neither decrepit, weak, nor feeble, Pettingill.
He was likely as mad as, opines Dirty.
At least that is a good simile, nods Pettingill.
Just about where are you pelicans headed for? Asked Dirty.
Headed for? Asked Pettingill. Where are we going? We desire to locate as near as possible to the habitat of the shepherd. We purchased the mules from a person in Silver Bend who assisted us in selecting our provender. He tied it securely on the mules, and we haven't taken it off since because we are afraid we could not get it on again.
How long have you been in the hills? I asked.
Since yesterday morning.
Suffering scissor bills, snorts Dirty. You left them burros packed all night because you... Say, you fellers all get jobs herding sheep. You sure qualify.
Ah, says Middleton, pleased like. Do you think it could be arranged?
To herd sheep?
Exactly. It would put us closely in touch with the subject. We could make a close study of the effects of the sheep animal upon the human brain. My dear Pettingill, that would be wonderful. Could it be arranged?
I'd rise and howl that it could, says Dirty. You get the job.
This is too good to be true, exclaims Pettingill.
Same to you and many of them, says Dirty. Hump yourselves, mules. We're going home.
Them professors seem to heap interested in our rag house. They makes a lot of notes in their little books while Dirty lays a fire in the little sheet iron stove. Then they wants to know where the sheep are.
You fellers want to be regular shepherds, don't you? Asks Dirty.
Oh, certainly, says Pettingill. We're prepared for the worst. I am anxious to get the first-hand information on the subject. Professor Middleton and myself are never content to take hearsay evidence for any weighty subject.
Being as we ain't never seen the sheep ourselves, we has to trust luck. We leads them pelicans to the top of a tall butte, and from there we gets a glimpse of the herd. Several hundred are feeding on the other side of the little creek, which we deciphers to be Mesquite Creek.
Now, what procedure do we adopt? Asks Pettingill.
Say that again, says Dirty. I missed it a foot.
What are we supposed to do in a case of this kind?
Oh, says Dirty, and then he cranes his neck. Look what's going on down there.
We sees four punchers riding towards them sheep, sort of swinging round to get between them and the creek. They bunches the whole works and proceeds to drift them over the hill. I recognizes one of them as Sandy Sorensen, on the roan, so I reckon it got home all right.
Exactly, remarks Pettingill, wiping his glasses. No doubt everything is all right, but just why are those men taking away our sheep?
Gents, says Dirty, rolling smoke, you have witnessed the theft of a few hundred sheep. With your own eyes, you have seen part of your herd swiped by outlaws. It is a common occurrence hereabouts.
Do you mean that we have been robbed in the broad light of day? Asked Pettingill, shocked like.
You do? Well, I am amazed.
Yes, says Dirty. It is such things that help to make us crazy.
Maybe I could tell more of this tale. Maybe not. Professor Pettingill knows things that I don't, so I'll let him tell the rest of the tale as he told it to his friends. Folks, meet Professor Pettingill, who is now going to talk.
Mr. Harper's tale, up to the present, is partly true, or, as Dirty Shirt says, near the truth as Ike ever told anything. I objected to the word pelican, as it applied to Professor Middleton and myself, but Ike assured me that it was a term of endearment, so I will let it remain. Many of their quaint phrases are in my notebook, but as yet I have not had time to investigate their meaning. Their vocabulary of profanity seems unlimited, and at times very amusing. It seems that they had little reverence for the finer things of life, and when we gently remonstrated with them, the one called Dirty Shirt said, "Oh, go to hell." What do you think this is, a lady's cemetery? I as yet fail to see the reference to a burial place. As Mr. Harper has already told you, we sat on the slope of the hill and watched the outlaws purloin part of the flock. I believe that my ancestors were fighting stock, for my gorge arose at the sight and I was filled with visions of revenge. Perhaps it was the spirit of the West that possessed me, but at any rate I arose and shook a folded fist in their direction.
"Go ahead and cuss, Professor," said Dirty Shirt. "If you get stuck for a word, maybe me or I can supply it."
Now, I am going to make no attempt to quote them. At times they talk in academic English, and at other times a jargon. Professor Middleton will bear me out in saying that their language is both weird and wonderful, and also easy to acquire. I am sure that our friends were shocked at our conversation when we related our experiences, and it required constant vigilance over our tongues to keep from, as Ike said, talking like a he-man. I feel that Middleton was a worse offender than I in that respect. I said to Dirty Shirt, "We shall most surely follow them and recover our property, shall we not?"
"Not,"
answered Ike. I am leaving off the prefix Mr. because they rarely use it in conversation. "But," said I, "it is a plain case of theft, is it not?"
"Well," replied Dirty Shirt, "you can call it anything from petty larceny to train robbery, Professor, but I'll be damned if I ever was so fond of sheep that I sacrificed my skin in their interests."
"Do you mean you're going to let them keep the sheep?" asked Middleton.
"You still talking sheep? Let's go back to the rag shanty and scare up a feed."
So back we went. They showed no worry over the loss of the sheep, and I am certain they must be of value. The chops alone would be worth, but why quote prices? They led us back to the tent, and then Dirty Shirt said,
"If you pelicans won't be regular shepherds, you got to learn how to cook. See what you can find in your own packs, and then scare up a batch of biscuits."
Our pack luggage has been stacked in front of the tent, and as I walked over to investigate our provender, Dirty Shirt added,
"Cook anything you see, because my big insides are eating up the little ones."
He did not use the word insides, but his vulgar equivalent.
"Scare up a biscuit?"
asked Middleton.
"How does one scare up a biscuit?" "Build a fire in the stove," said Dirty Shirt. "All you have to do is touch a match to the kindling as the fire is all set. Then we show you the next step."
I went inside the tent, knelt beside the stove, and scratched a match. The sticks of wood over the kindling caught my eye. I moved one as I touched the match. One must betray ignorance to acquire knowledge, so I carried one out to them. "Pardon me," said I, "but is this some new preparation to combat the scarcity of fuel?" Dirty Shirt glanced at the stick, then at the smoke coming out of the small stovepipe, and then he and I grasped their hats in their hands and dashed away. It really was ludicrous.
"Come on, you fools!"
cried Ike, without stopping to explain.
"What an amazing thing to do!"
exclaimed Middleton.
"Why in the world are they..."
It is, of course, ridiculous to say that the world came to an end before Middleton's question had been propounded, but that is what seemed to happen. The earth seemed to vomit dust, flame, and smoke, and I seemed to feel myself being carried away. Ages later, I awoke. I turned my head and then said to myself, "Pettingill, you have been knocked topsy-turvy." I really had. I seemed to be trying to stand on my head in wet clay, although in reality, I found that I was reclining, head down, on the side of a bank of what might be termed an abandoned watercourse. Modesty forbids that I tell what clothing is missing from my person. I managed to regain my natural poise and turned sufficiently to allow my feet to slide down. Near me is a section of the tent containing the red flannel patch, and as I take stock of my surroundings, that patch seemed to loosen, and from out through the aperture emerges the head of Professor Middleton. "My dear fellow, are you all right?" I asked. He looked at me in a dazed sort of way and then spat out, along with a mouthful of clay,
"Go to hell! What do you think this is, a lady's cemetery?"
I could readily see that he was speaking from his subconscious mind, quoting from Dirty Shirt's reply to me. He got to his feet, not without visible effort, and we both looked at Dirty Shirt and Ike. Their gaze seemed to be inquiring, but I was as much at sea as they.
We are still alive, as you may see, I volunteered. Takes a lot of dynamite to kill a shepherd, nodded Dirty.
Dynamite? Asked Middleton.
A powerful explosive?
Concentrated, nodded Dirty. Regular old bustin' quick. Some son of a goat loaded the stove on us. Must have been several sticks.
5, I believe, I replied. Here's the 6th. I opened my hand and showed them a mass of what appeared to be fine sawdust and grease.
My, cried
Dirty, not profanely.
The old dictionary digger choked that stick to a mush. Don't drop it!
His order came too late. I suddenly realized what I was doing, what I had in my hands, and I cast it down as a deadly thing. Dirty and Ike seemed to sigh with relief, and then Dirty said,
Lord, ain't got much religion. I don't savvy nothing about Jonah and the ark. But I sure hands up thanks to whoever's to blame for knocking the trigger off that thing. Amen.
Have you any special creed or religious affiliations? Asked Middleton.
Nope.
Dirty Shirt shook his head.
Not yet. But if you two are going to hang around this range for any length of time, I'm going to join something that's a dead cinch.
There was a cap in that stick, Dirty, said Ike. Wonder it didn't go.
Mm-hmm, grunted Dirty.
There's something that protects drunks and idiots, Ike.
Yes, Dirty, you're right. Even them dang burros was removed far enough away to be safe. Drunks, idiots, and jassacks, all under protection.
He certainly was not referring to Middleton or myself, as neither of us ever touches liquor in any form. Later on, I insisted on knowing the probable destination of the sheep.
Over in Sandy's corral, said Dirty Shirt. Everything's grist comes to his mill. He'll demand payment for the range he thinks the sheep ate.
Oh, is he a miller? Asked Middleton. Dirty and Ike exchanged glances, and Ike said,
That's what education does for a feller, Dirty.
Education had little to do with it, as anyone would know that no one but a miller would have need of a grist, and he spoke of his mill. Dirty proved adept as a chef, and Middleton and myself enjoyed the first real meal since we left the dining car. When it grew dark, Ike kicked out the fire, leaving us in darkness. I remonstrated, but he said,
Build you one if you want, old-timer, but remember this. Any Jasper who'd load your stove won't hesitate to shoot at night.
We spread our blankets in the dark, and Ike and Dirty immediately fell to sleep. The novelty of looking at the stars and the noises of the night kept Middleton and myself awake. I thought of the stolen sheep, and we conversed in whispers.
The loss of so many sheep must be greater than they care to acknowledge, whispered Middleton. They are like the American Indian, inasmuch as they are stoical under loss or punishment. It would be wonderful if we could recover the sheep. I'm beginning to like them, Pettingill.
We shook hands over it, procured our shotgun and pistol, and stole away silently, except for the tinkle of Middleton's spurs. We crawled out of hearing, got our bearings from the stars, and started on our well-meant errand. We were going in single file along the side of a hill on a tiny path, which showed white in the dim light, when suddenly we were confronted by a gigantic figure. It towered above us, a black hulk coming at a fast walk. I tried to avoid the impact, but slipped and fell right into the path of the monster. The next instant it fell over me and into Middleton. I regained my shotgun. I had no way of knowing the fate of poor Middleton, but I ran a short distance before I stopped. I saw the silhouette of it against the sky, and for the first time in my life, I fired a gun. The impact of the shot threw me into a cactus patch, and I feared for a time that it had crushed my lower jaw. I managed to tear myself away from the clinging barbs and stood erect. Middleton, I cried. Professor Middleton!
Well, what in hell do you want?
You can readily see that he was beginning to acquire the dialect of our associates.
I shot it, I cried. I shot it. Pettingill.
His voice was a bit sarcastic.
I will always thank the man who sold me these leather trousers. I didn't get hit with more than, let me see, oh, I am unable to estimate.
Heavens, did I hit you, Middleton?
Yes, you did, you,
pelican. What became of the monster? I asked. Did it say anything? It spoke. It knocked me down, got to its feet, and said, I am the ship hoarder. And then it went on, Pettingill. It went on with my shirt and its hands. If you ever feel the need that you have to shoot again, hold low, old-timer. Then we went on. Middleton complained about the effects of the shooting while I suffered untold agonies from cactus spines and the effects of that shotgun. We should be able to see the mill, said Middleton, peering into the night. But all I can see is a huddle of low buildings. One is larger than the rest, but none would be suitable for milling. We walked closer and closer. Finally, a canine barked several times, and a man came to the door of the larger house. Middleton and I crouched down behind an old vehicle. Some more of those coyotes, I reckon, said the man in the door. They smell the sheep. And then he shut the door. They do not mistrust us, said I, which simplifies things. No doubt they will be enraged at the coyote in the morning. Do you know what a coyote is, Middleton? No, I do not, and perhaps it is just as well. Just then we heard the gentle lowing of a sheep. Perhaps it was the call of one to its mate, and we knew we had come to the right place. We crossed to a fence, inside of which we found the sheep. The gate was locked, but Middleton immediately went to work to break it with a rock. The noise he made seemed to irritate the canine again, causing it to emit staccato barks. I fear that dog will upset our plans, Pettingill, said Middleton as we heard the door open again. Not at all, I reassured him. We will use strategy. A coyote is a young wolf, don't you see? I will dissemble. I have never made a study of the cries and calls of wild animals, but I did the best I could. Clearing my throat, I began a low-voiced howling, such as one hears in the zoo at feeding time. The dog only barked the louder, and then came voices.
Coyote, cried one. That's a banshee with bronchial trouble, Sandy.
I stopped howling. The dog stopped barking, and then we heard,
I have a hunch, Mickey. Give me them shells loaded with number sevens. This ain't no buckshot party.
Ah! Thank goodness the barrier is removed, exclaimed Middleton, and I heard the chain fall. Middleton gave the gate a shove, and it creaked open.
Sick 'em, Shep, cried a voice.
It is likely that the dog misunderstood orders, as I feel sure that its master meant us when he said sick 'em. But the dog circled us and went through the fence after the sheep.
Run, exclaimed Middleton. They're coming out.
Middleton was right. Just at that moment, one of those sheep tried to go between my legs. It was a large one. Too large, in fact. I grasped it with one hand, quickly holding my gun in the other, and attempted to ride it away, but it sprang for a place where all of the fence was missing except for a barbarous wire stretched along the top, and I went backward into the dirt. I managed to roll over and get to my hands and knees just in time to be struck a murderous blow from the rear, which projected me under the wire and outside the fence. There may have been other openings in that fence, but I will wager that a large percent of those sheep came through there and walked over me. After the procession of sharp hoofs had passed me, I crawled back and recovered my gun. I had no idea of where Middleton had gone. In fact, I don't believe I gave him a thought. I got to my feet and limped away, feeling rather dazed, as a man might feel after being hard hit, as it were. I toiled up the side of a hill, and suddenly I discerned Middleton. I knew him by the silhouette of his hat against the sky. "Thank goodness I have found you," I exclaimed.
"Same to you," he replied. And it was not Middleton's voice, but the voice of the party who suggested the banshee.
I saw the glisten of his gun as he turned. I don't know what prompted me to do it, but I leveled my gun and pulled the trigger. The roar deafened me, and the concussion hurled me backward, but I had presence of mind enough to crawl away. Suddenly, I fell into a depression, where I lay quiet.
"Hey," cried a voice. "Was that you, Mickey?"
"It was. Worse luck to me, Sandy."
"Was it a shepherd?"
"I won't swear to nothing until I say meself, but from the feel of me, I'd say it was a duck hunter."
"Ouch!"
"The divil blazed away at 60 feet and almost cut the boots off me legs. Bird shot by the handful." "Which way did he go, Mickey?"
"How should I know? I always hides me head in a storm of bird shot."
"Where in thunder did you get that hard hat?"
"Down by the corral. Did you ever know a shepherd to wear a baked bonnet before, Sandy?" They talked in low tones for a few moments, and then I heard the one called Sandy say, "Well, they're well scattered, and there's no use hunting in the dark. Next time we'll pack Winchesters when them woolies cross the Mesquite." "Sure, and I'll wear armor next time I hunt for hard-headed shepherds in the nighttime," replied the other, and their voices died away into the night. I managed to clamber out of the hole, suffering extreme torture all the while. I had not the slightest idea of direction. In fact, I seemed to be lost. At any rate, I climbed the hill, went down the other side, and then climbed another, where I sat down on a rock. It was very, very quiet up there. Finally, a dog came along. I tried to be friendly, but it slunk away at my whistle, and then another one came, and another. I said to myself, "Pettingill, there must be kennels near here." From a distant butte, against the pale light of the moon, I saw several more, and then came a wailing howl. From near me came a blood-curdling answer. I said to myself, "Pettingill, those dogs are wolves." The realization was painful. I really believe I grew homesick. In all that waste, I could not see a tree. I peered around. Ah, on not a too distant ridge stood a tree. I stood erect, grasped my gun, and hurried up the slope, spurred onward by the howls of at least a million savage throats. Perhaps it was undignified, but I ran, actually ran. Luckily, the branches grew low, and I was able, suffering as I was, to climb into the sanctuary of those thick branches. I breathed a sigh of relief and exclaimed aloud, "Thank heaven for this tree." And from above me came, "Pettingill, it is fortunate that you spoke, as I was about to pistol you." "Middleton," I gasped, "you here in this tree?" "Yes, I could find no other. I thought perhaps you, that perhaps that sheep had come back, don't you see?" "Sheep? Sheep do not climb trees, Middleton." "Well, I am glad to know there is some one thing that it could not do. I would readily believe it could climb, Pettingill." "How did you happen to pick this tree?" I asked. "I claim no credit whatever, Pettingill. As the sheep came out of the gate, one of them struck me very, very abruptly. I landed outside the fence where I tried to conceal myself, but it searched until it found me, and each time I tried to get up, it knocked me down. From there to this tree was just a succession of hard knocks." "That is really too bad," I replied. "I'm physically imperfect myself, Middleton. I think there is nothing more that could hurt me. Have you a comfortable seat up there, Middleton?" "Wouldn't use it if I had," he actually grunted at me. "Right at present, I am hanging over a bow like a carpet on a line. Pettingill, I may never, never sit down again." We cheered each other as much as possible through the long night, and were truly grateful when morning came. Looking at Middleton gave me a faint idea of my own appearance. He had neither shirt nor hat, and the upper part of his body was streaked with blood and dirt. His limbs were so stiff he could hardly walk, and mine were little better. I still retained my hat, although the crown would open and shut in the breeze. We wished for the coats we had left at our camp. Then we walked in what might be the right direction, and suddenly came to a road. Not a well-traveled thoroughfare, it is true, but at least a roadway. Along this we limped for a while, when we heard the creaking of a wagon behind us. "Just suppose there should be some ladies aboard," suggested Middleton, and we hastily crouched down beside some bushes. When the equipage was almost up to us, we saw that the team was being driven by a man, and that there were no ladies. We would ask for a ride. We stepped into the road and threw up our hands, signaling him to stop. The driver was smoking his pipe, but as the team halted, he opened his mouth, letting the pipe fall to the ground. Then he sprang to the ground, grasped his hat in his hand, and ran back down the road as fast as possible. His limbs were very badly bowed. "What a ridiculous thing to do!" exclaimed Middleton. "Abandon his equipage in this manner before we have had an opportunity to question him? What will we do, Pettingill?" "We will drive on. No doubt the team will take us some place. It is reasonable to suppose that a road leads to something. I hope we will eventually arrive at some place where a physician resides." We climbed in, and Middleton took charge of the lines. It was much better than walking, although neither of us could occupy the seat. All went well until we came to a steep hill where the horses seemed unable to check the speed of the wagon. I spoke sharply to Middleton about our speed, and he rudely replied, "Oh, if you're going to be a shepherd, be a regular one, dang it." I fear that Middleton would soon acquire a profane vocabulary. Somehow we seemed to lose the road. I spoke to Middleton about it, thinking he did not know,
and he shouted in my ear, "Go get it if you want it, you dang pelican." I pondered over his apparent rudeness, and the next instant the team seemed to be taking us straight over a sharp pitch, the wagon swaying sharply as it crashed over rocks and brush. I caught a glimpse of the bottom of another abandoned watercourse, and then, with a lurching crash, I was hurled into oblivion. I dreamed of lying under a splashing fountain. As I opened my eyes, I looked up at Dirty Shirt, who was pouring water into my face from his large hat. I heard Ike's voice say, "This old pelican ain't dead, Dirty. He just spat out another tooth."
"Say, Professor, when'd you take a job driving a sheep wagon?" asked Dirty Shirt.
"Middleton was driving," I whispered. My voice was strangely weak.
"Well..."
Dirty Shirt scratched his head and peered across the hills.
"Well, as a driver, he's got more intestines than judgment. He sure is a shortcut, kid."
After a while, Middleton sat up and essayed a grin. Several of his front teeth were missing, which gave him a leering look. The wagon had smashed into kindling wood, but they told us that the team escaped serious injury. Dirty Shirt and Ike told us to take it easy while they rounded up the team, which we tried to do. My gun was in the wreckage, but beyond a deep dent in the barrel, it was in very good shape. There were still 4 cartridges in it, and I managed to manipulate one into the firing chamber. It is well to be prepared. Middleton had acquired a pronounced lisp, caused no doubt by the missing teeth. Suddenly, we saw a man on horseback coming down toward us. Ordinarily, I would have paid little heed to him, but we were becoming wary of strangers. I stood up and threw my gun to my shoulder.
"What in Sam Hill's the idea?" he asked, halting. "Put down that gun."
"Shoot him," lisped Middleton. "Shoot him if he cometh too close."
"Have a little sense. Put down that gun," said the man.
"Don't let him disarm your suspicions," warned Middleton.
"Go back," I ordered. "You're in danger."
"Devil's light," he exclaimed. "There must have been a break in the loco lodge."
And we watched him ride up to the top of the hill.
"Nice general sip," applauded Middleton. "Looks somebody else."
Another rider had joined him, and they both came riding down to us.
"I shall be compelled to fire upon you if you come too close," I warned them.
"Shoot the shit out of them, said monkey with us," said Middleton.
The new one was very tall and grim-looking, with long mustaches and a very large hat. He appeared to uncoil a long rope, then showed his teeth in a snarling grin.
"Going to shoot that thing, hombre?" he asked.
And I nodded emphatically.
"You know best," he answered. "Get all set, because I'm coming to get you."
He spurred his horse forward and sidewise, and just then I fired. I felt that I had wasted the shot, for I pointed where he had been. A terrific force seemed to crash into me, my lungs filled with smoke, and somewhere in my consciousness I seemed to hear a deafening explosion. Then I seemed to feel myself bouncing and sliding over the ground, only to stop with a grinding shock. A still, small voice within me seemed to say, "Pettingill, your sands of time are running low. A human being can stand only so much, and you've had your share." And then I came back to life. I heard voices, far, far away, and someone laughed. The laugh grated upon my nerves. It was as if someone had laughed aloud at a funeral.
"The barrel's dented 2/3 through and bent bad," stated a voice. "Wonder it didn't blow his fool head off instead of just kicking hell out of him."
Then I sat up and looked around. I was propped against a rock. Around my chest and over my arms is a tightly pulled rope, and the other end of the rope is fastened to the front end of a saddle on a horse. 2 men are standing near me, examining the remains of my shotgun. Middleton is sitting near me, his hands and feet roped, and as I looked at him, he vulgarly spat out through where a tooth had been and winked at me. The 2 turned, and I saw upon the bosom of the taller one the badge of a police officer.
"I don't think that old off had brains enough to go crazy," said the other. "Gotta have some brains to start on, I reckon."
"Never can tell," nodded the tall one. "They caught him trying to put dynamite in the stove. Said he was going to blow up the law. Funny thing about it, somebody had filled his pants with birdshot."
Just then we were interrupted by the coming of Ike and Dirty Shirt, leading the runaway horses. They stared at the strangers.
"Holy hen hawks!" exclaimed Dirty. "They roped our shepherds."
"Uh-huh," nodded the tall one. "You might say a few words, Dirty."
"Hello, Adams,"
nodded Dirty to the other ones.
"Meet Professors Pettingill and Middleton. Gents, This person's Alcohol Adams, the tall one's Magpie Simpkins, the sheriff for Yower Rock County. He's just as bad as he looks. Magpie, what you got ropes on them pelicans for? It ain't done nothing.
Well, talk a little, can't you? Asked the Magpie person.
Well,
Dirty Shirt rolled a smoke.
We tried our dangest to fulfill our deputization, Magpie. These scientific pelicans pilgrim long and we take them in, Sabi. They wants to know from personal experience whether it's sheep or just general wear and tear puts a shepherd into that mental condition known as crazy. They had a hard time, gents. They sure have heard it in the interests of science. We all had a hard time, Magpie, and I'm off sheep forever. If Senior Sims and Alphabetical Aiden wants them sheep rounded up, they have to do it themselves, Sabi. Law or no law, we're all done.
So? The sheriff scratched his long nose and began a silent laugh that shook his gaunt frame. You poor loco snake hunters. Listen, I didn't no more to get started for Pipe Rock when I meet Senior and Alfie. They done patched up their differences. We went over to notify you, but you never showed up. I've been looking for you.
Ha! Replied Dirty Shirt vacantly. You, say who in blazes owns the sheep we've been dry nursing, Magpie?
I do, said Mr. Adams. I had a Swede out there, but he went loco, I reckon. I tried to dynamite Senior's camp, and Ike stepped over and took the ropes off Middleton and myself. I met the driver of my grub wagon, said Mr. Adams. He had been drinking too much lately, I reckon. He said he was held up by twin devils, and that from now on he's through with booze or sheep. We went down the hill where Middleton and I recovered our coats. Dirty Shirt and Ike caught our mules and put on the packs. Then they gave us each a rope to lead with. Road over there would take you to Silver Bend, explained Ike. We thanked him heartily and then shook hands with them all.
I hope you gents got the information you desired, said Magpie.
Nothing like personal experience.
Yes, we got it, lisped Middleton. We solved it.
I hope you didn't jump at it sudden-like, grinned Magpie.
No, sir, not sudden.
I reckon it's a mistake to say that all shepherds are crazy, observed Magpie. Cowmen use that expression more because they hate sheep than because the shepherd is loco. They figure that any man is crazy who would herd sheep, sabe? What is your scientific opinion, gents? Do you think they're crazy? I looked at Middleton inquiringly, and he nodded.
I will support you, Pettingill.
Well, said I, after personal observation, I will say this much. If he isn't crazy to begin with, and doesn't go crazy, he is a superman.
Reckon the sheep are to blame? Asked Adams.
Of course, lisped Middleton, caressing his back. The sheep are primarily responsible, but I'd say that the greater evil cometh from general wear and tear.
Which goes to show that personal experience is better than hearsay, agreed Magpie. Ordinarily, I agreed, but from now on, I will be more than willing to take unsupported word for things I know nothing about. How about you, Professor Middleton? Middleton picked up his rope and spat through his vacant teeth.
Oh, hell. Let's go, Pettingill. You'll set a mouthful.
That was Shepherds for Science by W.C. Tuttle, narrated by Stephen Howell. What a heroic effort from Steve. A long, complicated story with a diverse cast and some very quirky language. Quite a challenge even for an accomplished narrator. While longtime fans might remember Steve narrating Live Bait and The Game of Rat and Dragon back in episodes 9 and 10 respectively, the obvious comparison here is his performance of Jack London's That Spot in episode 39, another frontier comedy of errors. Thank you, sir, for so many great contributions. To contribute a little of your own colourful language, leave a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. And please don't forget that the District of Wonders runs on your donations. Consider helping us out with our hosting costs so that we can keep sharing great pulp tales with you. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrand. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 82, where we'll bring you Satan's Boneyard by Leon DuPont. Before you try swearing at a tent, don't forget to check who's inside, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.